So today is day five of reimagining human flourishing. And today the topic we will take up is the topic of implementation and evaluation. And we've learned many things this week. We've learned that it's time to take this wonderful work to scale. We've learned that teachers are the key, that we must train teachers. We've learned that these programs, these SEL programs, which now can expand to include secular ethics, are embedded within systems. And we've also learned that the systems themselves have mixed intent. School systems. And so within the systems, there's mixed intent. And we also learned that we must have universal responsibility if we're going to be successful. And so within the systems, we also understand that there are children, there are teachers, there are school principals and school leaders, civic leaders, business leaders, all of the folks involved. So one of the challenges ahead will be to open the doors of the hearts of these many people that are the guardians of children. So today we will hear from two amazing presenters. On my left is Sonia Lupien, and on my right, Tish Jennings. And Sonia is going to talk to us about stress. She's an expert in the area of stress. And she's going to make the point that children, if they're under too much stress, it's impossible really for them to learn. And so all of the pressures from the system that end up on the shoulders of the children, and she's going to be speaking about that. And Tish, on the other hand, is going to bring a very hopeful vision and actually example of a compassionate city wherein many of the leaders, the teachers, the principals, the mayor of the city have come together in alignment in bringing an SEL program into a whole community. So,
Your Holiness, good morning. It is an honor to be here today. Thank you to yourself and to Mind and Life for giving me the opportunity to be here. I came from my beautiful Canada because, as you and everyone in the room will agree with me, I came here because we all consider that no child should be left behind. And I just want to explain this to you exactly what I mean by this. So let's play a game. And let's say that I am a teacher and I'm going to go in a classroom to teach social emotional learning, which is SEL, or secular ethics. So I'm teaching. And when I'm teaching, this child will learn, will, you know, memorize and pay attention. This other child will also pay attention and he will learn. This child, this girl here, will also learn. And this other boy in the back will be able to learn. However, this girl here won't be able to learn. Why? Well, her parents are divorcing and they are in very important conflicts and she doesn't know what's going to happen. This boy here, this girl in the back, will not learn as well because, you know, for the last 2 weeks, she has been bullied and she's scared. This other boy here in the front will not learn because, you know, his sister is sick and he doesn't know what's going to happen to her. Now, the common denominator of these three children is stress. And I have been studying the effects of stress on the brain for 25 years. And what I have learned over these years is that stress impairs learning. And I'm not going to summarize all these studies because they are boring. But it took me 25 years to find the mechanism by which stress impairs learning. And I just want to share it with you because it's quite simple in the end. So how does stress impairs learning? Well, each time the brain detects a stress or a threat, it will produce stress hormones, and we talked about it. And, you know, they are named glucocorticoid or cortisol. And we talked a lot about this, but something we did not say is that cortisol, within a period of 8 to 10 minutes, that's fast, this stress hormones go back to the brain. And when it goes back to the brain, it has an interesting preference for the brain regions that are involved in learning and memory and attention. So, and when these stress hormones go back to the brain, the first thing that they affect is selective attention. Now, selective attention is...
If it is the hormone that is, you know, the stress hormones that are attacking the brain, can't you inhibit that by taking a medication?
I tried and it doesn't work. The only way we found to decrease it...
So because it is a physiological process, that one would expect some kind of pharmacological intervention could work.
Yes, we tried it. The thing is that the hormones, they all talk to each other. And if I inhibit one, I inhibit all the others and we get sick.
Then,
So the only way to decrease the stress hormones is to de-stress. So when they get to the brain, they affect selective attention. And selective attention is the capacity we have to discriminate between what is relevant and what is irrelevant. And we will memorize only what we...
So in terms of causal chain, stress is the cause, which then triggers this process.
Yes, I will come to that. Yes. Yes. So, and selective attention, so we will encode, we will put in memory only what we think is relevant. Now, when the stress hormones go back to the brain, for the brain, the most relevant information is the threatening information. So, you know, parental, physical abuse, etc. And this explains how these children cannot learn. Now, for many, many years, we tried to find what are the situations that will induce the production of these stress hormones. And we found that there are two types of stress, absolute stressors and relative stressors. An absolute stress is a threat to survival.
No, so how do you define them?
I'm coming to this. Absolute stressor is a threat to survival, war, extreme poverty. Okay, and relative stressors, we found it took us 25 years, but we found that there are four characteristics that will induce a stress response. And the more you have, the worse it is. So in order for a situation to create the stress response, it has to be novel. It has to be unpredicted or unpredictable. It must be threatening to your ego, to your personality, and you must feel that you don't have control over the situation. When we teach children, in order for them to remember this, we tell them, stress, don't go nuts. Okay?
Nuts, like you call it. Nuts. Nuts say they miss. Same trouble, because nuts say it. They say, don't go nuts, like you call it. Same trouble, say.
So, when anyone is exposed to this, they will produce stress hormones. The third question I ask myself, do children produce stress hormones? Because perhaps they are protected, we don't know. So I tried to find situations that could stress them. And yes, they do respond to stress. We found, for example, that poverty increased stress hormones. Here you see the level of stress hormones in poor children. SES is socioeconomic status. And we found that as early as age 6, poor children produce too much stress hormones.
So His Holiness has heard that the stress of the mother during pregnancy affects the fetus.
Yes. That's the work of Michael Meany, and we have been showing this, and Michael has been showing this for many years. This is why I'm going to come up to the importance of training people to de-stress. We also saw that maternal depression.
So given that mother's state of mind, particularly being afflicted by stress, affects the unborn fetus, does the father's stress also affect or not really?
Your Holiness, that's a point that I've raised in one discussion. The problem we have in our science is that fathers do not participate in our research.
Research participating in Mendoza.
They do not.
So it's because they are not listening to you.
But you know how we have them participate? We tell to their wife, make him participate, and then they do.
So. Because, you know, the point His Holiness is getting at is that sometimes there might be a genetic component to vulnerability to stress, in which case the father's role will be in.
It has been shown in some studies, and Richie knows about them, showing that if when the father has a stress, even before conception, this stress response can be given to future generation. So it's very important. So we saw as well that maternal depression is related to stress hormones in the child. What I mean by this is that the more the mother is depressed, the more her own child will produce stress hormones. So this is important. So let's go back to the classroom. If we want all of these children to learn what we all have to tell them today, it's going to be very important to first decrease the stress response in those who are suffering so that all of them can learn. And this is, you know, when I decided to do a program that we call De-Stress for Success. And this is something you said this week when you said destructive emotions are based on ignorance. I totally agree. So I said, let's teach them about destructive emotions. So the program, I'm not going to go through the program. This is not the point here. But basically, we want to be very simple because we know they're not learning. So we want them to think about factors that they find stressful, and we teach them about the nuts. We show them how to recognize a stress response and what to do to decrease it. We have tested the efficacy of the program. This is a young girl giving saliva, so we measure this in saliva.
Stress hormone.
We have tested that in 500 children, 12 to 14 years of age, and we knew that it's not all children will respond because it's not all of them who are suffering. We found that the best predictor of responding to the treatment is anger. So this is the level of stress hormones 3 times during the school year.
Can you say that again about anger?
So we knew that the program would not work in all children by decreasing stress hormones because some children are fine. So we found that the only factor that explains those response to the treatment is anger. So this is the children who started the school here with all high level of anger. If we do nothing, these kids did not have the program. This is the stress hormones on the left side. You see that the stress hormones will increase during the school year. Now, the children who start the school years with high level of anger, and those children who start the school year with high level of anger and having the De-Stress for Success program, it decreases. So we are doing something good here.
Program the matebena kudu lung the yaya tatumpar. That program the ten lung the mashidunya.
We also measure the depressive symptoms of these children, and it significantly goes down. So by teaching them, we do something good. I cannot go in all the school because we are all alone doing this. So we decided to train the teachers on this so that they could go back in their school and teach the children. So you see, and they come to us because we don't have the means to go to them. So every year we have hundreds of teachers coming and they tell us how many children they train. And so far we have trained about 65,000 children through the teachers. It's not a lot. We have not trained millions of children. But you said something else this week. You said even if it is a small action, it may become a seed. And let me, just in conclusion, show you a seed. When we came into the classrooms, we asked the children to draw how they felt. This is a drawing at the beginning of the school year before the program. And this is in French. And
program, comment.
Before we gave them the De-Stress for Success program. This is the drawing of a young girl, Juliette, 12 years of age. And it says in French, stress eats you. Okay. This is the same.
Stress eats you. Stress can ask to search.
Okay. And this is a drawing of the same girl after the program. So see, destructive, constructive. Because we have to decrease stress before they can learn.
That's
it.
So it really also powerfully demonstrates the negative effects of anger.
Yes, absolutely. When you are stressed, you are angry.
Say, Solon is curious now that you have shown this effect on children. If you introduce this de-stress program to grown-ups, particularly those who are really short-tempered.
I have done it, and let me give you a nice story.
It's harder.
One day, the phone rings in my lab, and it's the father of one of the children who had the De-Stress for Success program. And he said, my son is 14 years old, and he doesn't talk a lot. And one day we were at, and he said, I'm a financial broker, you know, like, very stressful job. And he said, one night we were having dinner all together, and I was, you know, talking about my day to my wife, and I was saying, you know, how stressful it had been, etc. And then my son started to talk to me, and he said, oh, Dad, for sure it's stressful, it's novel, it's unpredictable, you don't have control over it. And then it made sense to me. So he said, I'm calling you to ask you, did you ever do this for adults? So we did it for adults. It's a program on computer called Stress Inc., you know, and now we give it to the adults as well.
So can you say that it helped decrease proneness to anger?
Yes, we have done a study with one of my colleagues in Montreal, Pierrick Plusquelec, who has tested the validity of the program in people working in the medical field, and it decreases anger and stress hormones as well. In those who are suffering, this is what we want. The others, it's fine. They just have the information, which is okay.
Well,
because anger can be caused, can be of two types. One is legitimate anger. There's a reason, justified anger, and you respond with a certain, anger. But there could be sometimes anger just created by our mind. You know, we start thinking a thought process, and then it sort of makes us worked up. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's related to anticipation.
So the first type of anger is probably harder to treat because there are justified grounds for being angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You need it. So, and you said it. Some of all this, stress is good for survival. We need it. But we don't want to go too much,
Stress
level.
Correct So stress is not purely mental. Stress is a physiological response.
It is a physiological response.
You know, being hypervigilant and trying to anticipate and respond. But the problem is when you stay there for too long, it gets a problem.
You know what we think? We think...
No. So His Holiness is connecting that with our discussion about monitoring awareness. So how does that fit in with stress and hypervigilance?
Yeah, I think that the capacity to monitor is very critical in being able to regulate one's stress. Because not everyone, when they're stressed, actually knows that they're stressed. It can make them angry without awareness, yeah. Which impairs their ability to regulate it.
And stress,
actually, Misha, let's stay with the presentation here, yeah. Thank you.
So, if I may, before I give the talk to Tish, my colleague, you were supposed to come to Montreal, and unfortunately, you were not able. So,
Thomas in Montreal,
So we asked the people from Canada if they had the opportunity that I have to be sitting with you and ask you one question. What would it be? So Canadians send us a lot of questions, and we took the most frequent questions that Canadians want to ask you. So if you allow me, I'm going to ask you the question. So in the context of human flourishing and learning, here's the question of the Canadians. Scientists have been developing artificial intelligence, you know, like computers learning by themselves. Do you think that one day scientists will be able to create an artificial consciousness?
Very difficult.
I'll bring back the answer.
Consciousness.
Intelligence.
So people have, you know, some people speak about artificial intelligence and increasing ability to actually create consciousness, but that is going to be really difficult.
But you see, it is worthwhile. Make some research and experiment. Okay. Firstly, artificial brain.
The mic is
okay. Huh? One occasion in Japan, so some scientists,
So, His Holiness, it reminds him of a discussion that he had with some scientists in Japan, and many of the participants there were very optimistic, talking enthusiastically about artificials and its capability, and speaking of the possibility of creating consciousness, but he doubts. That's, he really doubts. But there is nothing wrong in furthering the research and continually striving. But ideally, it should be done in an ethical way without, you know, abusing animals.
I suspect many of the scientists around the table share your skepticism about the progress of artificial intelligence in creating actual consciousness.
Thank you. You support me now.
I do as well.
I think the intelligence said, but what's I'm going to do?
that I mean, even from an evolutionary point of view, the human mind and consciousness is a product of millions and millions of, you know, processes. So even the brain, the evolution of the brain has taken such a long time, across generations and millions of years. So it would be quite hard to see how something like that can be artificially created.
Thank you.
Well, as a non-scientist, that brings me great relief. Do one more.
Your Holiness, I am so grateful to have this opportunity to speak with you. For my whole entire life, I've shared a vision of peace in this world and through the lives of children. So my work has been focused on that. I started my life as a teacher. I consider myself 50% teacher, 50% scientist. This is me a long time ago. Maria Montessori inspired me because she wrote about peace in education. So I became a Montessori teacher and taught these practices to children many years ago. But I became very concerned because as I started teaching teachers, I started working in teacher education. I was observing classrooms and helping support teacher education, and I saw this stress that Sonia was talking about. And so I became really interested in studying this context, this classroom. Why is it stressful? Why is it difficult? And it's kind of nuts. If you look at this picture, this is what sometimes it feels like when you're teaching and the stress level of the teacher is going up. It feels crazy. It feels like nuts. I'm going to zoom in a little bit here so you can kind of see all the little things that are going on. It's unpredictable. There's a lot of things going on at once. And if you think about it from an attentional and emotional perspective, the teacher has to pay attention to all these things going on and at the same time teach one child, and keep this content in her head or his head at the same time. It's really challenging. So what we see happening is that these demands that we're describing create emotional exhaustion. They become exhausted. And as a result, they start becoming more reactive. Their stress level goes up. And when their stress level goes up, they imagine threat where there is no threat. So when they see this, it triggers the stress response.
His Holiness was saying that looking at this image itself can create more stress.
Exactly. The other part of this context that is important to keep in mind is these people in this room are confined. They're confined. They can't leave. If the teacher leaves or the student leaves, they get in trouble. You know, it would be like telling everyone in this room, you cannot leave. It creates stress to feel like you can't leave. So, teachers become more reactive. And one of the things we find that they do is they imagine that there's a problem where there is no problem. And this is what I saw that really concerned me, because a student would do something that the teacher misinterpreted, and she would get mad at that student and punish that student. And it would have a very negative effect on that student. And there was no reason for it. It was this stress-induced anger, right? Like Sonia was talking about. And then what happens is when the teacher acts that way, the students get more disruptive, and it adds to the stress. And so I was watching this happen, and I thought, how can we help these schools? What can we do? And so with my colleague Mark Greenberg, who I know you know, we started thinking about this. And what we realized is we have a whole lot of research that has shown us, as I'm going to look at this model starting from the right, the student social, emotional, and academic outcomes that we're trying to achieve. We know the classroom, this healthy classroom environment where there's peace and happiness and children are getting along. We know that predicts these outcomes. We also know that in order to create this classroom, we need healthy student-teacher relationships. We need a classroom management that's functioning well. And we need effective social-emotional learning programs. What we didn't know is what kinds of teacher social and emotional competencies do teachers need in order to do this? So for the last decade or so, I've been exploring this question. What do teachers need? How can we help them? And I happened to run into a program called Cultivating Emotional Balance right after the dialogue in 2000 that Dan documented in his book, Destructive Emotions. And so I began to work on this study in San Francisco back in 2004. And so in this program, as you know, there was a combination of emotion skills and mindful awareness practices to help with destructive emotions. And the first study I did was with the Varela Award to see not only does it reduce stress, which we did find, but does it improve how they behave in the classroom? And we found it didn't. So then we thought, okay, why not? We talked to Paul Ekman, who you know, your friend, your good friend Paul, and he said, well, I think these skills need to be specifically designed to connect to these stressors. It can't just be general stress reduction. So working at the Garrison Institute, which I know you visited, my colleagues and I developed a program called Cultivating Awareness and Resilience in Education, which is an adaptation of CEB, of Cultivating Emotional Balance. And we call it Care for Teachers, which teachers really like because they really need care and they appreciate it. This program, the way we've studied it, is pretty intensive. It involves 30 hours of training over 5 full days. And in the research we did, we spread this out over the school year. So in the United States, the school year begins in the fall, in September, and it ends in June, in the spring. And we did most of this in the fall with these teachers, and then we did a booster, like one more, in the spring. Between the sessions, we also talked to them on the phone because we wanted to help them apply what they were learning to their own stressors. So the CARE program is composed of 3 primary components, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail unless Your Holiness has some specific questions, but there are compassion practices, emotion skills training similar to CEB, and mindful awareness practices. The thing that I think is particularly interesting is we have found that we start the program with teachers reflecting on their own ethics. Because teachers come into the teaching profession with a strong feeling of compassion for children. You wouldn't want to go into this job if you didn't really care about children. So we help them connect with that. And then we teach them how to set their intention so that they constantly can monitor their behavior in relationship to their intention, which is exactly what Richie was just saying. So that we teach them that when they start feeling stress, they recognize it because the mindful awareness helps them notice, I'm feeling stress. We also teach them that when they are feeling stress, it can change their perception. And then they can say, oh, maybe what I'm seeing is maybe not true. They can take some breaths, they can calm down, and then they can respond more effectively to their students. So we did a large randomized controlled trial of the CARE program. We did a large randomized control trial of CARE in New York City in high poverty schools. We chose high poverty schools because we assumed that we wanted to show impacts on students, and we assumed that the students who need a supportive teacher the most would show the most impact. similar to what Sonia was talking about. So we were going to see, does care improve the teacher's well-being and their ability to regulate their emotions? Does it improve the classroom quality, this classroom environment that we're talking about? And also, does it improve the students' outcomes? So that's what we looked at. What we found was that it definitely improved the teachers'. It improved their emotion regulation. This is just showing you. And the thing about this is it's showing you the fall before the training. It's showing the spring after the training. And then the fall of the following year. So adaptive emotion regulation continued for a whole entire year. We also showed the same effect on mindfulness and also on a reduction in psychological distress. Another one that we did show effects on is something called time urgency, which is stress associated with not having enough time. Because you can imagine in this context where there's all these things happening, and you look at your watch and you say, oops, I've got to finish this. That's that kind of stress. With these classrooms, we observed the classrooms and rated them using a measure called the class. So it's a very objective measure of quality of classroom. And we showed a significant improvement in emotional support, positive climate, and teacher sensitivity. And this is really important outcomes because this is the first time this measure has been shown to be affected by only working with the teacher. And no curriculum, no change in the way the teacher was teaching, just helping reduce the stress of the teacher. We also showed that the classrooms were more productive. Oops. The other thing we found, which I don't show here, is that there was a direct positive impact on student engagement. So all the students were more engaged as a result of care. But we also showed an interesting effect for only those children who showed low social skills. So these are students who really need SEL because their social skills are low. They improved in reading.
Social skills because it's not all
that. I'm not sure.
Social skills.
You would define social skills as a relationship skills, yeah?
Yes, exactly. And so they improved in reading, which is an interesting finding as well. So this is the CARE program, and it was designed for teachers, but we see it as part of a larger system, as Aaron was saying, because the teachers by themselves can't do everything. And so another project that we've been working on that you may already be aware of is the Compassionate Schools Project, because I understand you just met with Mayor Fisher from Louisville, Kentucky last week. The city of Louisville, which I think you're aware of, is a compassionate city.
Yes.
He's identified it as a compassionate city. And what we've found is that in this city, we've had this wonderful opportunity to create a systems change that includes care. The teachers are receiving care. They're also receiving an SEL curriculum that we've designed that's a health and physical education curriculum. And the teachers are also engaging in some of these practices, too. We're doing a very large randomized trial of this program in the city, and we have 46 schools already involved in the research. And the picture on the left are the teachers after they did the CARE program in Louisville. And then the right is a picture of the curriculum for the Unit 1 of the K-1 curriculum. So I have a short movie that I would like to show you of this project. This is what I would end with.
At first, I didn't really know what to expect because it's never been something that I've experienced before. Like, I've never had like a class devoted to how to be mindful.
It's different because there's not like chairs and desks everywhere.
It is absolutely like nothing else anyone has ever seen before, but it's a wonderful change.
When I visit elementary schools, it's clear that there are some obstacles that are getting in the way of learning and achievement.
We have students who aren't necessarily ready to come to school and aren't in great positions to learn. What Compassionate Schools is doing is it's helping students learn those appropriate coping strategies. How do we solve problems? What is this emotion that I'm feeling right now?
Everybody sit up nice and tall.
Before, it was just calm down. We'd simply say calm down. Now we're teaching them strategies that they can actually use and benefit from throughout life. This has been kind of the missing piece.
What I like about the Compassionate School Project is that what problems I have at home, I can release them during CSP.
Usually when I come in here, something has happened during the day and it just helps me calm down. Having a younger brother and sister, having to take tests. Sometimes when my cousin's over, he drives me nuts a little. And he woke me up this morning and drove me nuts. And I like coming in here because it's very easy to take the stuff that you had in the morning or in your life away.
What I've noticed is students really are fascinated with that idea of compassion for other people. And I think it seems like something they've almost been craving.
Mindful means that you take your thoughts, your inner feelings, and you use them in your benefit to get through your day, to worry about yourself, to deal with frustration.
It's a big difference because I have used what Mr. Wedding has taught me. I take it to classes and at home, teaching my parents what I've learned in CSP.
I think that we want our world to be a more peaceful place, and we want our citizens to be more thoughtful and more mindful about the decisions that they make when they're interacting with one another.
So what's at stake is our kids having a great life, our kids having a future, and they're counting on us. They're absolutely counting on us to figure it out.
Wonderful. Really wonderful.
Thank you, Your Holiness. I also want to acknowledge Owsley Brown made this film, and he's here, and he's also been a major benefactor of this project. So I just want to acknowledge him as well.
Yes? Any questions that you would like to ask?
Nothing special yet, yeah.
Thank you.
Other than to say thank you, and it's wonderful.
Thank you for your inspiration, because it's played a big role in this work, and it keeps us going. So thank you.
So, Your Holiness and everyone here, I'd like to focus our attention on the topic of implementation. So what we saw here was there were principals involved, children, teachers, a mayor of a city, philanthropists, who all came together with around this vision of educating the heart and made that a priority. And I'd like us, for our own benefit here, but also for those who are watching on the live stream, to take a look at what made that possible, and anything that we can understand about that, so that we can share the learning and share the knowledge. So maybe beginning with you, Tish, if you could share some stories about that, but also others here on our distinguished panel who may have some thoughts about this as well. And we have about 20 minutes or so before the tea break, so we can take this time until then doing that.
So thank you for that question. One thing that was amazing about this experience of working in Louisville is the fact that we had this mayor with this vision. And one thing that Mayor Fisher has said is that working at the city level is a good place to work because it's small enough to really see change, especially medium to small size cities. You could really work in those spaces. And his inspiration brought a community together and with the leadership of the superintendent. And so when we started this in Louisville, I was so surprised at how quickly we were able to recruit the teachers, recruit the schools, get this project underway, raise the money. This project is completely funded by private philanthropy. We have no federal money. So it can happen, and I think that is the exciting part of this, but it takes leadership in key places where people really understand the need for this kind of social change.
Thank you, Tish. Others? Yes, Danny.
Hello? Yes. On the other hand, there are challenges, and I think we need to be realistic. I think it's the United Kingdom and England. Social-emotional learning programs are mandated from the top. The national government says every school should teach this, but because it's not implemented well, because teachers, for example, are not prepared to do it, I believe it's done poorly in many places. And the reason is that the teachers see it as an added stress, something else they have to do. So I think that the way it's brought into a school is very, very important as to whether it'll work. Would you agree, Tish?
Yes, and thank you for saying that, because there was one other
social emotional learning program. The lab that I met,
So in terms of implementation, the teacher is not only teaching skills, but is embodying them. Because the way children learn these skills is by observing adults behaving this way. So our teachers, they learn, one of the things they learn is that when they're starting to feel stress, one thing they can do is they can teach their students what to do. So they say, I am feeling stress. I notice tension in my shoulders. I'm going to take some breaths and calm down right now. And so the children not only get to see how the teacher is doing that, but they get to see the teacher calm down. And it's a really lesson in action.
I have a very practical question to Sonia. How long is the training takes?
That's an important question. Yeah, okay, it's fine.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice story. When we started, we thought that I have created this with my team and my lab, and when we started, we thought that us scientists knew everything. So we decided to do it by ourselves. So we had 12 sessions of 1 hour each. It never worked. It was way too long. So we put everything aside, started again, and then we did it with teachers, school counselors, and children. Now it's at 5 because they didn't want to go below 5 sessions of 1 hour. But when we teach the teachers, we say, you take what you want. You want to take one session because you have the time for one, you take one. The take-home message is this, and then you do what you can do. And I want to agree with Dan about implementation. Something I feel sad about, and we were talking about this with Kim, is that the probability that a child who is suffering will be exposed to the program totally depends on the will of a school director. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is sad. This is why we are starting to think of ways, mobile applications or mm-hmm. whatever, that could reach children. And I'm not sure that implementation in schools should be the only way, because mm-hmm. some of these kids are left out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tish, thank you for such a beautiful presentation. One of the moments in the video that you shared that touched me the most was the little boy who said that being mindful is taking his suffering and having it be of benefit to others. And it reminds me, in answer to your question about implementation, Aaron, that young people are powerful partners in this process. Your Holiness, in the United States this week, young people organized themselves across the country to walk out of schools for a brief period of time to object weapons and guns in our schools. And this is some young people have organized in ways that have made, some would argue, greater changes in the last few weeks than many adults have been trying to make for many years. And so it reminds me, as we think about implementation and the challenges, and I agree there are challenges, but I think that it's essential that we partner with young people and raise up their voices, because they are such powerful messengers and ambassadors of the importance of this work.
Thank you. Mishi.
Your Holiness, I'd like to ask you a question tied to this topic of implementation. And one of the things that we've learned through my work, which I mentioned yesterday to the group, a lot of it has to do with offering these programs to groups such as active duty military, is that they benefit. When we have now gone from offering them a 40-hour program, which they said was too much time, down to 24 hours, 16 hours, 8 hours. 8 hours seems to be where we have a limit. If we go to 4 hours, there's no benefit. So my question to you is this. Once we find that they benefit, meaning that their stress levels are lower, their attention is greater, their ability to resonate with others and understand the perspective of others is better.
The program, the Lebe Kablas, the Moran program, the mindfulness, the Mangmiso Labor, that the Lobzen, the Tambungi, the Kevoja, the Ned, the Kanta Chutukele, Manyunga, the Nashu can take him into Salaban.
So the question is this. After they go through the program and they benefit, we're no longer involved. It's on them to do the daily practice. We ask them to do 15 minutes of daily practice. And this is mostly a mindfulness practice. They don't continue. And when we look at their results a month later, they're right back where they started. So my question is, how would you encourage us to think of ways to have them practice every day? How can we help implement it into their daily lives?
Stress, fear, all these related with anger. Anger related with self-centered attitude. So this part of our nature. A few weeks, or even a few years, not much effect. Now here, if you permit me to explain, I'm a Buddhist monk. 82 years old. I think certain my mental sort of mental state. I think is a production of last 70 years effort. Not easy.
Wow.
That also, just to say, how to reduce stress, very superficial. We have to go the causes of stress, as I mentioned earlier, to this feeling. So then, there are many because of the
factors.
Many factors. So these factors, then, shedala chabokumya, dejala mitukumya. That the any go chesik nyabutanchir toga. ただ、ただ、チクチは、てかさ、ポイントにもた。ほ、信じめ。たそうな、たそうな。信じめ。信じめ。信じめ。ああ、で、信じめにもかどかどかど。だれ。だてかれれりゃ、えね。かだえね。ポイントにもしてもいたべ、ともるくしゃれて、いねだてかね、もし、もしこわるわ。だれ。と信じやこい。順前やだこわるわ。 人に
So this is a very, very challenging question, because in the Buddhist contemplative practice and theory behind it, there is an understanding that with specific problems like anger or, you know, excessive attachment and so on, there one can apply specific, you know, antidotes. So, for example, to counter loving anger and hatred, you cultivate loving kindness. To counter, you know, attachment, you reflect upon the impermanence and other, you know, features, attributes of that phenomena. But these are seen as, in some sense, temporary measures. These are kind of, you know, but in order to really, you know, get at the roots, one needs to have an overall approach, which in the Buddhist tradition, you know, touches upon having a deeper understanding of the nature of reality. This is where the concept of emptiness comes in. So until, you know, you are able to really get at the root and have a radical change in your outlook, you know, it's difficult to sustain that kind of, you know, state.
There's a certain method for temporary effect or benefit. It's something like tranquilizer.
Like a tranquilizer pill, yeah. Oh.
Now, our tradition, firstly, Indian tradition, before Buddha, the other day I mentioned, already the tradition of shamatha, tradition of
single-pointed meditation,
Sangdong,
and then cultivation of insight.
Oh. That from then the pebni any shine da shira ga naba chin ye Sangdong chigo ge dangi mindus. That deeper kind of rock edge. That from then the korang lulu kaje tu zen shu kobo shine indu zane any.
So, although the techniques themselves predates the Buddha in India, such as cultivation of single-pointedness of the mind and cultivation of insight. But what the Buddha did was he brought a level of depth in the application of these two techniques, particularly in relation
to...
So particularly the cultivation of insight. Buddha brought a special sophistication to the... application of insight, vipassana. Oh. And particularly...
Now, there are differences of... the philosophical view, what's the reality? So the understanding about the reality, different level. And then the deepest sort of level, reality, now quantum physics, some way you see closer to that degree.
So where the Buddha bought great sophistication and depth is the application of insight, and particularly to really understanding the human condition. And so as a result of his 6 years of meditation, and when he finally came out of it and became enlightened, there's a line which says that I found the truth of the unconditioned reality, which is so profound, but I... It's profound, tranquil, beyond conceptualization, and it's like a clear light. And he says that, you know, I won't be able to share with others, so I'm going to remain silent. So then, of course, he...
So till Buddha come, the common sort of, or so the understanding is there is Atma,
self,
independent self. So that's all existing Indian tradition.
Yeah. Mm. So the radical
although
nature,
they practice shamatha, and now even today, you see, in Himalaya, there's a mountain, some snow mountain area, completely naked, and remain throughout whole year meditation. You see, without certain technique to increase inner heat, otherwise it's impossible. So still there. But there, the ultimate sort of view is, or there is independent, absolute self.
Atman, yeah.
Now, Buddha denying that.
So the radical nature of the Buddha's discovery was the rejection of that, denial of that.
Now, that is the unique thing, Atma and Anatma. I think the other sort of spiritual tradition over 3,000 years. But the particular sort of what's the understanding about reality, the further sort of
refinement. So the teaching of the no self was first presented in the public ceremony in Varanasi at the Deer Park, and this was further elaborated, particularly on the truth of cessation and the path, in the second turning of the wheel, where now the teaching on
and Rajagiri,
the teaching of
so the first Dharma teaching is common, Pali tradition, Sanskrit tradition. Like Four Noble Truth and the 37 practice, common. Now the second Dharma wheel at Rajagiri, then he further elaborated
long.
The cessation.
Right.
What is a cessation? Is it possible? Generally, is it possible? Or particularly in my own my own case of cessation, is it possible? Now we need sort of explanation. Firstly, theoretically, then implement, then some experience come. Gradually that experience increasing, then you will get conviction, cessation is possible. Mm-hmm. How? The old suffering based on ignorance, as I mentioned yesterday. Mm-hmm. So suffering, no solid basis, but ignorance. So the ignorance of the ultimate reality. So then the concept of shunyata.
Emptiness. Yeah.
Hmm? Mm-hmm.
So at Rajagiha, the essence of the Buddha's discourse was on perfection of wisdom, which especially the fourfold formula, that form is emptiness, emptiness is form, there is no emptiness other than form, and there is no form other than emptiness.
Mm-hmm. So now that teaching, now tackle the fundamental ignorance.
So that's what gets at the root.
Mm-hmm. That part, I have sort of, I can explain according to my own experience. Over 60 years, I seriously thinking the whole day and some other sort of practice there, but the foundation, key thing is understanding nothing exists independently. Mm. Then combined with altruism. Really
powerful.
Very, very powerful. So to Tomovane send Nyomo Bishawan to Song Nyomogza, that the Mudenzi and the Dejashana Timusum number tall and Jon Sums. That the Kim Zen Shay in Zane and took them to Chijilo.
So the Nagarjuna says that our emotions such as attachment, anger, and delusions arise from our false conceptualization. So Buddha taught it. So, and our attraction and, repulsion of towards an object and indifference is also a function of the interdependence of things.
Mm-hmm.
So Aryadeva further elaborates on the Nagarjuna's teaching, although he's reputed to have been born inside a lotus, but he seems to have a great mind.
So because he born from lotus, so therefore his brain is something very special. So the kasa lulu liwa chishin do timu kuna na kyo te tenshiri nyomo tamja kya timu chompe chomar gyurus ona timu chompe yate kari chumkura salam na eni tenshin drabana chungwa kang tongna timu chumun gyurus tenshiri beba kunkin dir tamta tomar nyebar chas beri chan tanga tu senri gu nyam doli ya chigi samkham rin guwabena siya tenga da chigi tenri nyam doli ya nama yimi kishik kaya amari chiba yimi kishik kaya amari kishik tenga nyam do siya togdo kala
hari
Sasanga, yeah, she gave it 6 years. Any Sanji Jisun Goku, Kanshi Tosum Genu, they don't want ye then they didn't want a easy chance. She was several, Shukshar Shasuja.
So Aryadeva gives the analogy of the body faculty. Just as the body faculty underpins all the faculties, other faculties like visual, auditory, and so on, in the same manner, delusion underpins all of our, you know, destructive emotions. So it permeates all of them. And then how can we then deal with it? He says that... So if he says that if you see the truth of dependent or arising, then it will prevent the arising of delusion. And therefore, with all your effort, engage only in the discourse on dependent arising. And then, on another occasion, he says that, when engaging with the Buddha's discourse, in certain sections when it's very obscure, you can only judge its veracity by first judging Buddha's accuracy in relation to things that you can reason and infer. Mm-hmm. So the point His Holiness is making is that, of course, these statements are made by a Buddhist master in the context of a Buddhist practice, but if you look at it, it really is talking about human condition and human experience, mm-hmm. and that's why it allows Buddhist practitioners and Buddhist thinkers to really be able to sit down with scientists like you and have conversations mm-hmm. and share insights from each other.
Mm-hmm. So, today's work, not easy. Question of weeks or hours or weeks or months or years or decades, but a whole life, and not only one life, limitless lives.
Yes.
So therefore, we practice, you see, develop determination. So long space remain, I will remain, in order to serve others. So these tremendous sort of bring them, these thinking, tremendous sort of, because enthusiasm, willpower.
Determination.
Determination. Not a foolish way, but clear sort of understanding. What is reality? Do you have some rejection?
No.
So in any way, I really appreciate, you see, you now, they're trying to show human being, not only mathematics or history or geography or not like that, like these things, but there are certain fields which we, in the past, we ignore.
Neglect.
Now, this...
Neglect.
Now we must pay. Now these are something relevant. Day-to-day's life. Too much stress. Unhappy. Peaceful. Peaceful calm. A peaceful mind. Calm mind. Even surrounded by difficulties. A lot of problem. But you individual can maintain very peaceful, happy person.
Yes.
Very good. Wonderful.
Thank you, Your Holiness. So we'll take a tea break now.
Yes.
And we'll be back in 15 minutes.
Oh,
that was great.
So it reminds him of another text which says that the word dependent arising, dependent, you know, connotes the rejection of any idea of independence of things.
Yeah.
And arising suggests something coming into being. So this is what, you know, the good excuse for having a tea coming into being.
Okay, so we're going to begin now. So if we could bring our silence. Yeah, thank you. Your Holiness, so we continue our discussion about implementation, and I ask our amazing group here to continue to add any insights and knowledge that you have about this topic of implementation. Okay. So let me just tell you, we have Tish, we have Richie, and then we have Tony. Well, we have this whole line right here. It's amazing. So, Kim.
I wanted to address Amishi's question because we actually collected data in our work that gave us some insights into that question, because as you saw, we had this longitudinal data, and we did show that with practice, with more practice, there were greater effects. But the key, I think, is we gave them a lot of choice about how to practice. So we, in the coaching sessions, we helped them tailor their practice to their own needs. And we also encouraged them to bring in their already existing spiritual practices or religious practices. So if prayer was their primary interest for practice, they could do that. And it seemed to be very powerful. And what we found was people were combining their prayer practices and their mindfulness practices, and sometimes they would do metta when they knew they needed to do metta, and they just learned how to tailor their own practice to support their own needs. And those were the most effective, the ones that we showed the greatest effects on.
So I wanted to just make a couple of comments, but first ask Your Holiness a question. Your Holiness, one of the things that you have consistently reminded us of is that the belief in a fixed sense of independence is the root cause of a lot of suffering, this ignorance. And for, I think, complicated historical reasons, most of the approaches that have brought contemplative practices to social emotional learning in North America have emphasized mindfulness, and I'll put it in quotes, rather than specifically more direct teachings on emptiness. And you, Your Holiness, have told us that you've been practicing for more than 70 years, and based upon our simple mental calculations, that means that you've started practicing on emptiness before you were a teenager. And so I wonder if you can share with us just a little bit about your vision of secular approaches to teaching emptiness, and how we might incorporate that in a more explicit way in some of the programs that are being featured that you've learned a little bit about over this past week.
Firstly,
great question.
Whenever I explain
So normally when I give an explanation on emptiness, I need to give a larger background, so it takes a lot of time. So in any case, whatever I say, sometimes, you know, it takes a long because I give the background.
So firstly, I always consider I am one of the human being, as I yesterday mentioned. So as a human being, one of the 7 billion human beings, each of us the responsibility to think about humanity, to think about the world, because it directly related with our own future, selfish viewpoint. And then, I think from certain viewpoint, we born this country, I mean, on this planet, not to create more problem. No, certainly not. You see, we born on this planet and this period, I think whatever way, directly or indirectly, some benefit to people. That's my number one commitment as a human being. Then second, religious harmony. I think other day I mentioned. Then third, as a Tibetan, preservation of Tibetan culture. In previously, say the Western, or say the Westerners who visit Tibet, they saw Tibetan as of the sacred dance or something.
So many of the rituals, some of which involve exterminating the enemies.
So you see, they describe Tibetan Buddhism as Lamaism, not genuine Buddhism. So I think Tibetan part also, you see, I think I usually blaming Tibetan themselves. They carry Buddha Dharma very superficial way. And consider important individual Lama. If that Lama sit on high throne, then they say, oh, great Lama, great Lama. Not judging, not examine that person's real quality. So Lama, something like become the because of the social, because of the status.
Social status, yeah.
Including Dalai Lama. Therefore, since 2001, particularly 2011, I totally retired from political responsibility. And as early as 69, I stated the future of Dalai Lama should continue or not up to Tibetan people. I do not consider Dharma Institution something important for Buddha Dharma. No. This Buddha Shakyamuni's institution, no. No institution of Nagarjuna. But that teaching still working. Study and practice, not the institution. I think the Tibetan case, you see, sometimes we too much relying on individual Lama. That's wrong. I think a whole Buddhist practitioner should be good Lama, like that. So I try to, I said, the way to preserve Tibetan Buddhist knowledge, as I mentioned earlier, you see, we Buddhists, particularly the follower of a Nalanda tradition, we should be 21st century Buddhist. That means the full knowledge about everything, including scientific finding. Then I think the Nalanda tradition have the potential to explain everything. So Tibetan Buddhist tradition is really worthwhile to preserve on this planet. Out of 7 billion, then out of about, I think, less than 1 billion Buddhists, I think Tibetan tradition is the only tradition which we preserve Nalanda tradition intact. Right?
Intact.
So China, follower of Nalanda tradition, but they not much pay attention for study.
So, given that the Chinese tradition does not emphasize the rigorous study, particularly of the use of logic and reasoning, in 8th century, there was a competition between the Chinese form of Buddhism and Indian form of Buddhism in Tibet. So the emperor was forced to
stage... Which Chinese Buddhism also originally come from India.
Come from India. So the emperor had to stage a debate between the Chinese side and the Indian side so that Tibetans will choose who the winners were.
So today, I think over 1,000 years since 8th century, we study, firstly, root text learned by heart, memorized. Then commentary, mostly wrote by Indian master. Each word explained. Then use extensively logic in order to utilize logical approach. We also learn all existing Indian tradition, not only Buddhist.
Philosophical thought,
All non-Buddhist traditions, sort of philosophical views we study, like Baba Bhikkhu's writing, talking about.
There is a text called Atarga Jwala, or Blaze of Reasoning.
So these immense helpful to get the fuller idea. This tradition say this. This tradition reject that. What's the reason? Analyze. Without that, just a faith. My tradition is best just to say that. Study, make a comparison. Then you get conviction.
Conviction.
So, third Mysore. And what, because of the
commitment
is preservation of this ancient knowledge which come from India. Particularly this, we, because of Indian, particularly we are very much anxious. Our teacher neglect the Nalanda tradition. So we as a chela, the student of Nalanda, have this special responsibility to preserve. Like that. So therefore, number one level, humanity level, not talking about religion. So certainly, I never sort of also raise question of certain sort of unique Buddhist sort of thinking on these things. In the, so many years, I never sort of discuss about rebirth theory.
In the context of scientific
like
discourse.
Yeah. Just for humanity, like that. So I very much appreciate Mind and Life Committee. And also, you see, many my friend. Now, really, immense help in the sense you give us encouragement. And you also, you see, find some useful information from our knowledge. So we never sort of consider propagating Buddhism. As far as Buddhist is concerned, I think sufficient number. Now important is quality. So therefore, as I mentioned earlier, we Buddhists should be 21st century Buddhists. Study more, including modern science, scientific findings. Then you will realize some of the unique Buddhist sort of knowledge over 1,000 years. As you see, Raja Ramana mentioned to me, quantum physics in the West, something new. In this country, over 2,000 years already developed.
Ideas. The ideas. Yeah.
Like that. So I very much appreciate all your effort. And you choose it's a certain sort of practice or a certain sort of thinking which is useful to humanity and education field. So you are taking interest in these things. I very much appreciate. In the meantime, I am never thinking propagating Buddhism like that. So thank you very much. you all really showing genuine interest or genuine kata sympathy or warm feeling. So thank you. Takato.
Well, I think
last few days after noon sort of meeting, any sort of opportunity debate ke chosme.
His Holiness is asking in the afternoon sessions, were there any debates between the monastics and the scientists?
I
was saying that one of the questions that came up was to Amishi's presentation about the demarcation where thought kicks in versus the pure perceptual process. That was seems to be some of the main questions from the monastics. Would you agree?
Yeah.
So, in fact, there is a saying for the debate training, and the initial training of the monastics is a pure learning the skills of art of debating. And then the real test of having mastered that technique is the following. If you can prove what is and turn it into not, and if you can prove what is not into is, then you have mastered the technique.
No enemies.
So in other words, it's only saying. In other words, it's only saying that you have nothing to hold on to. So, you know, more seriously, training in the debating and reasoning, you know, one thing that is very...
Logical approach.
So one thing that is very sure is that when you learn it from a young age, it really helps you sharpen your mind.
Okay.
Richie will bring a summary to us as we come to a conclusion.
So just a very brief overview and summary. When we first began the meeting on Monday, we brought to mind our previous Mind and Life meetings, and we remembered that there was a meeting in 2009 that Your Holiness participated in Washington, D.C., which was a public meeting on educating citizens for the 21st century. That was the first public meeting that we held on education. And what we saw over the last 5 days was really very much directly inspired by Your Holiness's vision. And I think that for all of us, while not content fully with the progress, I think that there has been tremendous progress that has been made. And these programs are now being implemented, designed, and disseminated in ways that were unimaginable even less than 10 years ago. And so I think that Mind and Life has really catalyzed this effort in ways that are really truly remarkable and are benefiting the science and also benefiting children, parents, and teachers in different parts of the world. And for all of this, we are so deeply grateful for Your Holiness's inspiration. Over the course of the time, we also brought together basic scientists and practitioners. This is something that actually happens very little in the normal discourse. Scientists tend to be meeting with other scientists, practitioners meet with other practitioners, and rarely do they have an opportunity to meet. And again, through Mind and Life, we've provided the context and the opportunity for these different groups to come together in ways that I think can truly benefit one another. And throughout the week, we have had discussions that range from the basic science, genetics, epigenetics, plasticity, to how these concepts have been implemented in real programs that impact children and teachers. And there are many examples of different programs that were featured throughout the week. One of the things that Your Holiness did not get a chance to experience was actually an exercise that Aaron led outside here on Tuesday afternoon that he uses in his Academy for the Love of Learning in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and had 40 people engaged in this exercise, which we think can cultivate aspects of meta-awareness and also other qualities that we talked about, and so gave the participants in this meeting a real direct experiential feel for how some of these kinds of methods may actually work. We then went on to discuss meta-awareness, which was a very important topic, and Jhimpala reminded us of, and you constantly remind us, Your Holiness, of while we may know a little bit about the brain, we know much less about the mind. And for this, we are so appreciative of the insights that we have gleaned from the Buddhist tradition and other contemplative traditions, the Nalanda tradition, particularly over the many years in which we have interacted. And it's not just we, the people that are meeting directly with you, that have benefited, but so many viewers on the internet and the students that we talk with are impacted by our experiences here in Dharamsala with you. And you have influenced a whole new generation of scientists who are very deeply committed to and motivated by the will to do good, to really benefit the world, and also have been humbled by the insights and the complexity and the nuances of the sophisticated philosophy and psychology of mind that we find in Buddhism. And that has been a very healthy juxtaposition that has really been important, and I think we'll see ripple effects of this beyond all of our lifetimes that will continue. And so this is something I think so critical. And then on yesterday, we moved to a discussion of how compassion and caring and ethics are studied in basic research. We moved back to basic research, and we also talked about some of the ways in which this basic research is being extended in value-based education programs that are educating the heart and educating these ethical dimensions. And then today, we ended with a consideration of understanding how stress can actually impact our very ability to learn, and then saw in Tish's presentation of such beautiful examples of this being implemented. And the program that's going on now in Louisville, Kentucky, is probably, certainly in the United States, it's the largest research project that's ever been attempted of its kind, and has the potential of influencing more than 50,000 children. And so we're beginning to bring this to a larger scale. One of the things that I frequently talk to the students in our center about and in public talks, and I hear the refrain in the back of my mind where Your Holiness always reminds us that there are 7 billion people and that this is really an urgent need, and we need to work together in whatever ways we can, using the skills that we have, to bring this to scale as quickly as possible, but also using wisdom as we go about this. And so this will be a conversation and a set of activities that will continue. We are already talking about convening a group of these, the wonderful people that are sitting around this table, at our next Mind and Life event, the International Symposium for contemplative studies that will be held in Arizona in just a few months. And this conversation will continue. But more importantly than the conversation, it's going to lead to concrete actions that I think will bring some benefit. So we are so grateful for your commitment to continue to meet with us. And may your life be long, and may you continue to meet with us and inspire us to continue this important work. Mm. Thank you so much. Mm.
Thank you. Very beautiful summary.
Naren.
Very good. Thank you.
Your Holiness, would you have any final words for us?
No, nothing. Magic. That's all right.
So, you know, His Holiness, it's not his style to prepare and make something very formal. He just responds, and then whatever comes to his mind, he, you know, shares it.
Okay.
So maybe in that case.
Yes.
So I'll do the final close. Thank I need you. A microphone. Shall I... Stand or sit?
Yeah.
No, 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 no. Formality. No, no, no need formality. Sit, sit, sit.
Sit's good. Sit's good with me too.
So you can be even more informal by having a candy in your mouth.
Later.
Later.
Okay. So. I'm officially closing the event, and this has been a remarkable, remarkable week. The 200 people that have been here experiencing it in this room has been, the energy, the enthusiasm has been palpable. But we also know that we've been joined remotely around the world by over 2.5 million viewers over the course of 5 days. So there have been about 500,000 people or more who have viewed this every day, including tens of thousands Tibetans, tens of thousands Chinese and Russians, and many more. So for those of you out there that have gotten up very early in the morning, stayed up very late, we are really grateful that you took the time to be with us, to be part of this conversation in the way that you were. I also, now I'm just going to express some very important words of gratitude, because if it wasn't for these the different individuals that have made this possible, we wouldn't be here. So just a few acknowledgments of deep gratitude. So I first want to express gratitude to Namgyal Monastery. Thank you, Gichula, and to all of the monastics who and your staff who have helped us to provide lunch and the tea breaks, welcoming us to your home. Thank you. And also an acknowledgement on behalf of the Dalai Lama Trust to acknowledge the many representatives who came, who made the time to travel here and to participate and accept the invitation to be here at the Mind and Life 33. So these institutions, Tata Institute of Social Studies, Kalinga Institute of Social Sciences, Punjab University, Smile Foundation, Vasant Valley School, Aryagyanyas, Tonglen Charitable Trust, and the Indian Tradition and Heritage Society. Thank you all for making the trip and being part of this conversation. And then to all the guests that are here, wow, what an interesting mix of people. And to the nuns and the monks that have been here and have asked such excellent questions and been part of the conversations, it's been wonderful. And to the many other guests that have come from many continents, traveled far to spend this time, we appreciate you taking the time to travel, and my wishes to you to travel safely back home. And to the faculty, you're all outstanding. So it's a really, really, really rich conversations. And the people who were here at the table would not have come together normally in our everyday lives. But sharing your different perspectives was just so valuable. So thank you for your time and all your work in preparing your presentations. And to the Mind and Life board, and also to the Mind and Life staff. We have several staff members, a handful of the team have been here, and then we have others that are back in the United States in Charlottesville, Virginia, who have also worked very tirelessly to make this possible. So thank you to the staff. And if you can stand, Mind and Life staff, please stand. And to the generous donors, many who are here and others who aren't, you know, Mind and Life Institute is supported really pretty exclusively by generous support of patrons, and the work that we do is only possible because of that support. So thank you for making this possible. And to our fabulous partners, the Dalai Lama Trust. You have an amazing, amazing team, and they have been so generous with their time and their support, and I have felt the resonance in our work together, and so I'm very deeply grateful to the Dalai Lama Trust, and you all know who you are, so thank you. And Dalai Lama Trust India, thank you. And then finally, Your Holiness. Deepest, deepest gratitude. You've been so generous with your time. Five days to be with us is a lot of your time. And we don't take that for granted. So thank you for the time.
My duty.
And...
Takwashwad.
His Holiness was saying that this is his duty, and that's his actually way of thinking. And on a daily basis, he makes the prayers, reciting certain verses which says that may my body, speech, and mind, in whatever ways possible, be of service to other beings. So his kind of, you know, understanding and concept of this altruism doesn't involve beating oneself. So in fact, the verse that inspires him most, one of the verses that has inspired him most, comes from Shantideva's text, where he says that therefore, you know, overcoming any form of tiredness, I will ride the horse of altruistic mind, and then ride travel to a place of joy, from one place of joy to another place of joy. What sane person wouldn't want to do such a thing?
So truly, when I was the that and then reflect what kind of day you spend. when I felt, you see, some sort of the contribution, then I feel very happy. Otherwise, you see, time, no force can stop, always go. Time utilized by Krishna in a foolish, selfish way, then waste of time, waste of this brain, isn't it? Use your time, your life, some help, some service to other sentient being, mainly human being. As a Buddhist monk, in daily basis, we pray all mother sentient being. Thus, sometimes I feel hypocritical. boundless, I think, galaxies. There are a lot of sentient beings. We can't do anything. We just pray, all mother sentient beings. It is impractical. So only this galaxy, this planet. And then on this planet also, I think I already mentioned, within this planet also, you see the limitless sentient beings. But we can't do anything except human being. So I use 7 billion, 7 billion, 7 billion. Because of the possibility only concerning human being, different language, different culture, but basically, physically, same, mentally, same, emotionally, same. So we can help directly or indirectly some way. So that's why I usually call 7 billion human beings exclusively.
It's all saying that as a Buddhist, of course, we pray for the, you know, all sentient beings, but on the practical level where we can have an impact is on the 7 billion human beings.
So of course I really feel happy and some
contribution.
So small contribution from my part. And the more important, you showing genuine interest. So I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Siddhu. Siddhu, what do you think? What? Siddhu, what do you think? Drawing is a Yuxin inside. Then what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? Really, you need to pen door doors, you know? Any? Let you see one day, Pungu de la de Orine, some nala, coach yourself to look.
Solomon was saying that in the Tibetan tradition, that the students offer to the guru, the teacher, some rituals that would help the longevity of the teacher. But he says that the real way to help with the longevity of the teacher is to really offer the teacher an opportunity to be effective, and also the students to also carry that and, you know, amplify that impact. So when even, you know, even on the part of His Holiness as a human being, when he sees that his words or action is having some impact, some contribution, that is a source of joy, source of fulfillment.
So this particular word mentioning, so so many, you must be shaman shinde or.
So, from the Buddhist point of view, all of us, you know, carry this body and mind, which is conditioned by afflictions and delusions and karma. But even then, when we are able to make a difference in someone's life, make a contribution, then you are making that your life meaningful.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Physically, now we're departing, but mentally, always together. Now important is, wherever you are, you see, you should implement what we talk here and try to share with more people, particularly the area or family who are really passing through difficult period. It is our
responsibility.
Responsibility to share, even small way, to help them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then, see you again. Okay. Next time.
Next time.
Okay. Next time. Yes. So everyone's standing. Huh?